Well, beloved, this morning, let's turn to Acts chapter 23 as we're making a little bit more headway. Acts chapter 23. Now, as you hold your place there, you don't need to turn, but I'm going to turn back to Luke 21, which was our opening call to instruction. And allow me to read in your hearing the following words. This is Luke's account of the Olivet Discourse. Now again, Luke was not present on the Mount of Olives when Christ gave the Olivet Discourse. In all likelihood, he was not even yet saved. So the question is, how did Luke get all this information? Well, probably, since we know that he was a good journalist and he investigated all the facts, he interviewed individuals who were eyewitnesses, I believe he got this from firsthand people who were there on the Mount of Olives, who heard the Olivet Discourse in its first giving by the Lord there. In Luke chapter 21, Jesus is kind of delineating some of the signs, some of the conditions that would be going on in the Roman world prior to Jerusalem's destruction. And then he says in verses 12, but before all these things, before these things begin to be seen by those that are on the ground, they shall lay their hands on you. This would be the Jewish authorities would begin to persecute the way and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my namesake. And we're going to see the Apostle Paul in Acts 23 and moving forward. He will stand before both Jewish leaders, religious leaders, as well as representatives of the Roman Empire at that time. This will become what Jesus here prophesied in verse 12 of Luke 21. For Paul is now about to become a reality. And it shall turn to you for a testimony. Settle it therefore in your hearts, verse 14, not to meditate before what ye shall answer. For I will give you a mouth and wisdom, which all your adversaries shall not be able to gainsay nor resist. Nor resist. And ye shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren and kinsfolk and friends. Now remember, and well, be prepared to see this in Acts 23. Paul is going to stand in front of the same council, the same high priest, the same cronies, way back yonder in Acts 8 and 9, that gave him authorization to go hunt Christians, bring them to Jerusalem, interrogate them, and if need be, put them to death. The same council, the same people that he once hobnobbed with, he's not going to stand in front. And that's what Paul, Jesus says, and ye shall be betrayed both by parents and brethren, kinsfolk and friends. At one time, the Sanhedrin and Paul were friends. Now, the table's been turned. And some of you shall they cause to be put to death. Well, at this moment, we saw what the past couple of weeks, they nearly beat Paul to a pulp there in the temple complex area. It wasn't until the Romans, they came out of that fortress, which is right against the one of the walls there that forms the enclosure of the temple courtyard. If it wasn't for a fortress Antonia and the soldiers being close enough to come to his aid, they would have killed them right on the spot, and he would have never gone to Rome. And ye shall be hated of all men for my namesake, but there shall not a hair of your head perish. Paul didn't die in Acts 22 when they were beating him to a pulp, because his work was not yet finished. He was still running the race. But in 2 Timothy 4, what does he tell Timothy, which we read about? He's coming to the end of the race. He can see the finish line. And the finish line was going to be his ultimate demise. Acts 23. And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. Can any one of us say the same thing? And the high priest, Annas, commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Now notice, all that Paul utters is what is recorded in verse 1. And the high priest's response was to have one of his underlings smack Paul across his face. Then said Paul unto him, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall. The apostle Paul, responding after being slapped, in a moment of justified anger, he was slapped for no good reason, calls the high priest a tombstone. Now, what do you find lying under the tombstone? Dead men bones. For sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law? See, Paul knew the law just as much as the high priest. And they that stood by said, revilest thou God's high priest? Paul, are you answering back God's high priest? Now, we're going to notice something. Paul was able to separate the man from the office. Then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, quote, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people, unquote. So, Paul here acknowledges the office of high priest, but not the man who sat in the office. Paul basically apologizes for showing disrespect, not to the man, but to the position in which the man sat in. So you can separate the man from the office. Okay? Well, beloved, in my call to instruction, which was Luke chapter 21, verses 10 to 19, years before Saul of Tarsus would be transformed into the Apostle Paul, Jesus forewarned what events would take place leading up to Jerusalem's demise and destruction in AD 70 under the Romans. Some of those events would be realized by Paul now in his life in Acts 23. So let's reread Luke 21, 10 to 19. I read it in part, so we're not in the notes here. We're not going to go back and reread Luke 21. But I read to you just a few moments ago a portion of Luke 21, 10 to 19, where Jesus forewarned before certain signs in the heavens, before certain things that would become a reality like famines and pestilence, nation against nation, wars against wars, things of that nation, before those things would become on the radar, Jesus said, prior to all of that, the enemies of the gospel will begin to attack you, my people, my ecclesia, my body, my espoused virgin, my bride, the church. They're going to come after you. Matter of fact, your friends and family members, your most closest associates, are going to be the one that's going to turn you in. They're going to be the one that's going to show the authorities where you meet in secret. You're going to be betrayed by family members, people who are related to you by blood and marriage. Your own children will betray you. Your parents will betray you to the authorities. And Paul now is beginning to dine from that plate of Luke 21, verses 10 to 19. In Acts 23, Paul is brought before the religious council known as the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was composed of two major factions, You have the Pharisees on one side, and you have the Sadducees on the other side of the aisle. There were approximately 70 or 71 members of the Sanhedrin. And the majority of the members of the Sanhedrin were Sadducees, meaning the Pharisees were in the minority. Allow me to read to you a little bit of history so you can kind of get a feel of when you read and hear about the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin, any of several official Jewish councils in Palestine under Roman rule, to which various political, religious, and judicial functions had been attributed. Out of all the peoples that the Roman Empire absorbed into its empire over time, they gave more allowances and more exceptions to the Jewish people. Believe it or not. Somehow the Romans were totally fascinated with this one group of people who only worshiped one God. Everybody else that the Roman Empire subjugated were worshiping everything under the sun, a god for this and a goddess for that, but not the Jews. They were stubborn. They were inflexible on this one God whom they call the creator of all things. And somehow, in the days of Julius Caesar and kind of working its way down until the birth of Jesus, during that particular period of time prior to the birth of Christ, you had a guy named Herod the Great. And for a season, Herod the Great was waving his flags for Mark Antony and Cleopatra. And then when Herod saw that Cleopatra and Mark Antony were going down the drink, going down the drain, he began to wave his flag for Octavia, who later on became Augustus, Caesar Augustus. And there were uprisings going on in the land of Israel, Palestine, if you will. And Herod maneuvered his way with the Romans to be granted that little spot of the Roman Empire, and he was dubbed King of the Jews. The Roman Empire looked favorably to the Jewish people and allowed them to have a little bit of autonomy when it came to judicial matters, points of religion, things of that nature, was granted and given to the Jewish people. This might floor you. All that time during Jesus' ministry and leading up to the Jewish wars, every day in the temple, the priest made a sacrifice on behalf of the Caesar. Did you know that? They stopped it during the Jewish wars. They cut off doing any more sacrificing on behalf of the good and the well-being of the Caesar. But for a long time, they offered a sacrifice every day on behalf of the Caesar, whoever it was there in Rome, for his benefit and for his well-being. Taken from the Greek word for council, the term was apparently applied to various bodies, but became especially the designation for the Supreme Jewish Legislative and Judicial Court. So kind of look at the Sanhedrin as a low-level Supreme Court that the Romans allowed the Jews to have. The Great Sanhedrin, or simply the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, there were also local or provisional Sanhedrins of lesser jurisdictions in authority. A council of elders or a senate, okay, also existed under Persian and Syrian rule, is considered by some scholars the forerunner of the Great Sanhedrin. So guess what? What eventually became known as the Sanhedrin, that body, that council, that would include Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, they were members of the Sanhedrin. Okay? That body could possibly be traced to its early beginnings when the nation of Israel was still in exile during the time of the Persians. Okay? And then as the centuries ticked on, this Sanhedrin took on more power, more prestige. And as we come down to the Roman era, the Romans just simply sanctioned its existence and said, hey, how about you guys keep law and order amongst you rebel rousers and you zealots? How about you keep the lid on? And if you keep the lid on and you keep peace and tranquility on this part of the empire that's so restless, we give you a green light. And that's exactly what was in place when Jesus came on the scene. Although eminent sources, the Hellenistic Jewish historian Josephus, the New Testament and the Talmud is the interpretation of the rabbis as they gleaned it from the first five books, have mentioned the Sanhedrin. Their accounts are fragmentary, apparently contradictory, and often obscured. Hence, its exact nature, its composition and function remains a subject of scholarly investigation and controversy. So even to this day, those that look at this council, again, look at Acts 23, verse 1, and Paul earnestly beholding the council. That's where I'm drawing your attention. He's standing in front of the council. The council here is the Sanhedrin. And amongst some of the big boys today, the function, the composition of that body that was in existence moons ago still causes questions and doubts what it was. How did it function? What was its composition? How did it do its job? Even now, there's back and forth with the big boys. In the writings of Josephus in the Gospels, for example, the Sanhedrin is presented as a political and judicial council headed by the high priest in his role as civil ruler. The high priest, under Roman rule, was given a little bit of autonomy. He was the kingpin. If anything went bonkers, Rome knocked on the high priest's door. Matter of fact, under one uprising, I believe in the days of Herod the Great, and when it was finally put down and squelched, you know what the Romans did? The Romans took the very garments of the high priest that he would put on for the Day of Atonement. They locked it up under lock and key. And it only came out of the closet for that one Day of Atonement for the priest to do his thing. And then it was placed back in the closet and locked up. Because the Romans knew that the high priestly garment, that was a symbol. That was like the American flag. And the people can rally around the one wearing that garb and go out there with sword and shield and simply attack Romans. The Romans was able to see the connection of the garb and the man, and they took the garb and they shoved it in a closet all year, except for the Day of Atonement. In the Talmud, it is described as primarily a religious legislative body headed by sages, though with certain political and judicial functions. Some scholars have accepted the first view as authentic, others the second, while the third school holds that there were two Sanhedrins, one a purely political council and the other a religious council and legislative. Moreover, some scholars attest that the Sanhedrin was a single body, combining politics, religion, and judicial functions in a community where these aspects were inseparable. So when you hear that, you get all the more confused. The composition of the Sanhedrin is also in much dispute. The controversy involves the participation of two major parties of the day, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Some say the Sanhedrin was made up of Sadducees, some of Pharisees, others of an alternate or a mixture of the two groups. In the trials of Jesus, in the Gospel of Mark and Luke, speak of the assembling of the chief priests, plural, elders, plural, scribes, plural, under the high priest, singular, referring to the whole council, or to their council. And the gospel according to John speaks of the chief priests and the Pharisees convening a council. The gospel accounts have been subject to critical scrutiny and questioning because of the extreme theological and historical significance of the issue. But none of the theories evolved has won scholarly consensus. It is still uncertain, for example, whether the Sanhedrin had the power to hand down a death sentence in the case such as that of Jesus. In the book of Acts, give an account of the trial of Peter and John before the council and all of the Senate, apparently one and the same, pointing to a split between the Pharisees and the Sadducee members of the Sanhedrin. So, when I read that to you, it sounds like, huh? Don't the scholars know what's going on? But I wanted you to get a feel. Verse 1. Paul earnestly beholding the council. Notice, earnestly beholding. You know what I think he was doing? I got a pretty good idea that as Paul stood there, now remember, the day before they were about to kill him, the mob there in the temple courtyard area. Roman soldiers rush in, save him. The head soldier has not a clue what's going on. He wants to know who Paul is and what in the world has he done to cause this uproar and turn the city upside down. He puts Paul in chains. Then the Roman soldier thinks, well, one way to get the information is to beat it out of him. And then the Apostle Paul uses what? His photo ID. Oh, by the way, I'm a Roman soldier. You're going to beat me without a trial? His Roman citizenship. You're going to beat me without a trial? And then the Roman soldier backs off. Big time. But the people that were beating Paul, they want their day in court. And so for the Roman soldier, this head soldier, for him to find out what in the world is going on, he agrees for Paul to be brought before the council so that he can hear the evidence. Who is he and what has he done to throw the city into a tailspin? All right? Now, it says that Paul earnestly was beholding. You know what I think is going on? Paul is looking at all the faces of members of the council that knew him as Saul of Tarsus. He's looking at them earnestly, beholding their faces, realizing that on just years earlier, he was on that side of the argument. He was on that side of the controversy, looking at them earnestly, looking at their faces. Wow. I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day, and apparently Ananias, the high priest, he couldn't take even that much to drop from Paul's lips and had him smacked. Wow. So on this Sanhedrin, I believe I'm simply going to take the scriptures here. Because I think Paul is going to tell us exactly what was the composition. And I'm pretty sure Paul was not a confused man. So hang on to your seats. So not only were there Pharisees and Sadducees, you also had priests, plural, scribes, plural, and lawyers, plural, also present on the council. So apparently there was somebody, if you had scribes there, what do you think the scribes are doing? They're recording the proceedings of Paul before the council. Just like when you watch a court proceeding, you got the stenographer there on the little machine or speaking, whatever, recording all the events, who said what to whom, the question, the answer, the objections, the sustaining, whatever. So you had scribes that are recording this event of what's now transpiring here. This is the same body that called for Jesus' blood. This was the same body that targeted the early church when you read in Acts chapters 3 through 8. This is the same body that authorized the stoning of Stephen and Saul of Tarsus, who now was the Apostle Paul standing in front of this council, was the one who consented to his death. That's why I think Paul earnestly was eyeing the members of the Sanhedrin. Now that same body, Paul now was standing before. Now listen carefully. The Sadducees would be today those on the left of a given controversy or a given issue. They would be your left wing liberals. The Sadducees were grounded to the ground upon which they walked. The only thing that they saw was the ground under their feet and the power to keep it. To do so, the Sadducees committed political prostitution with the Romans. The Sadducees would have been more favorably accepting Greco-Roman culture. They would be very favorable to the Hellenistic culture of that day. They would give it a nod. They would not openly criticize Hellenistic culture. They knew as long as they went to bed politically with the Romans, they owned the ground under their feet and they were able to hold on to it. So they were buddies with the Romans. They wanted political power and control. And when you put those two things together, cha-ching in the pocket. Cha-ching. Meaning at that point, gold, silver, property. So the Sadducees were your liberals like today who love power, love control, and beloved, they would lie, cheat, steal, and kill to keep it. The Pharisees, on the other hand, would be considered right-wing, very conservative. It's Moses or the highway. First five books of Moses, the law, that is our flag. We die on our sword on the first five books. They were more spiritually minded than the Sadducees. Deeply religious. Remember Jesus in Matthew 23, when he rebukes them, he tells them, you go out of your way to tithe the salt and the pepper and the sugar and the cinnamon and the nutmeg. Man, oh day, you make sure that last grain tilts the scale. But when it comes to righteousness and compassion and mercy, you strike out. And then Jesus told them, you should have done all these major things while weighing out the cinnamon and the cumin and the turmeric and whatever. Jesus didn't lambast them for the little measuring of the spices. He goes, you should keep doing it, but what about righteousness, compassion and mercy and forbearance and forgiveness and love? You ought to have done these, but keep on doing the measuring. They were devoted to the law and to the tradition of the fathers. What did Jesus say? I believe it's in Matthew 15. He says, by your traditions, you make the word of God of none effect. They would be orthodox. They were the zealots when it came to religion. They outwardly, passionately denounced Hellenistic culture. And there they are on the same council. But again, according to what I've read, it was the Sadducees who had the majority members out of that 70, 71 members. Beloved, Jesus was brutal when it came to his denunciation of these people. Brutal. Vicious. Because of what they became. and what they did with the word of God, twisting it for their own profit, and then using the law to trounce the common Joe on the street. Let's continue to read verse 3. Then said Paul unto him, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall. Now this Paul, in the raw. For sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law? Let's consider Leviticus 19:35 in this reference Bible. Let's see whether or not that has something to do with Paul here is saying to the high priest. Leviticus 19. Let's just take a peek here. Leviticus 19 in verse 35. And following here, ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meter yard, in weight or in measure, just balance, just weights, a just ephod, and a just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore shall ye observe all my statutes and all my judgments to do them. I am the Lord. So apparently here, the reference, this particular reference Bible, seems to be pointing to the spirit of verse 35. Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. So basically, the high priest was out of line in smacking Paul for Paul just simply saying, oh, I have lived in good conscience between God and man up until now.
My reference is to verse 15.
Verse 15? Okay, Leviticus 19:15. Okay. Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment. Thou shalt not respect the person of the poor or honor the person of the mighty, but in righteousness shalt thou judge thy neighbor. So again, the high priest, he went overboard. He smites Paul. I mean, look at Paul's words. I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. Now, when you read elsewhere in his epistles, Paul was very, very concerned about violating anyone's conscience. Okay? So how did the high priest know that Paul was saying something that was amiss? It was only because the high priest interpreted that way out of his own faulty thinking and faulty reasoning. And when he had Paul slapped, the high priest was wrong. Then Paul comes back with that comment, you white-walled, for you're going to sit and judge me after the law and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law. So Paul was looking at the spirit of the law, judge righteously. Then they that stood by, verse 4, said, revilest thou God's high priest? Are you talking back? And then again, then said Paul, I wist not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, quote, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people, unquote. Look at Exodus 22:28. Exodus 22:28. Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people. Now notice the word gods, that's the word Elohim. That word can be used in three different ways based on context. Moses here is not talking about gods like idols that we worship. This term Elohim is also applied to those who sit in a position of authority, like a judge. In this case, the high priest. Now, remember I just got done reading to you what all the big boys think? Well, let's see what Paul says. Ready? Verse 6. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, so Paul knew exactly the composition of the Sanhedrin. He cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the multitude, the council itself, was now divided. Notice how Paul throws a left hook and then a right jab. I like that. Remember verse 1? He's earnestly beholding. You know what he's doing? While he's looking at them, he's taking an inventory. Let's see. Sadducee. Oh, Pharisee. And notice how Paul turned the table. Remember what we just got done reading there in Luke? What did Jesus tell them? Don't even walk into your controversy with your 3x5 cards, with a speech already given to you. I'm going to give you words on the spot that when those words come out of your mouth, no one will be able to gainsay nor resist you. And so Paul just stands there. He's taking the inventory based on verse 1. He's looking earnestly, oh, by word, Sadducee, Pharisee. And he throws up his hands and says, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. And then notice this for my dispensational premillennial friends. If the Apostle Paul was looking forward for a 1,000-year reign on the earth, Jesus as the president, and I was informed this past week, David as the vice president, and a third rebuilt temple, and the reinstitution of bloody sacrifices, the reinstitution of the dietary law and physical circumcision, and an earthly high priest, we got a problem. Paul says, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope, not of a millennial reign on earth, but the hope of the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. That seems to be Paul's driving hope and confidence. Not the fact that the Apostle Paul was going to get a little bit of real estate in the so-called millennial reign with a nice house and a white picket fence somewhere outside of Jerusalem, maybe. Look at that. Paul is basically telling them, I'm standing in front of you, condemned in your eyes as a criminal, for the same hope that some of you also are hoping in, I stand before you. My confidence, my hope. Basically, Paul is telling them everything in the Old Testament was pointing to the hope of a bodily resurrection at the end of time. Where's the 1,000-year reign? Where's a third rebuilt temple? Where's the land of Israel being chopped up and given away? Where do you find Jesus sitting on a literal throne in the literal city of Jerusalem on earth and King David running as the vice president at that time? That's what I heard this past week from a well-known premillennial dispensationalist. That was not Paul's confidence nor his hope. That's what he said, not me. I love that. And then notice in verse 7, by the time Paul dropped that little atomic bomb in the council room, all the tension came off of him, and now you have Sadducees who rejected a resurrection bodily. Besides, they rejected the concept of angels. The Sadducees rejected the supernatural, while the Pharisees hung on to all of that. Paul just simply stood back and he's watching the council implode on itself. He just stood back and watched the fireworks. For the Pharisees say, look at verse 8, that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess or acknowledge both. So if you're taking notes, that tells you what the Sadducees were, what was the bottom line of their theology, if you will, versus the Pharisee. And there rose a great cry, and the scribes that were of the Pharisee part arose and strove, saying, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel had spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Notice the theology of the Pharisees come out. Their now concern is if he spoke the word of an angel, or if a spirit gave him those words, we don't want to fight against God. And there arose a great dissension. The chief captain, fearing lest Paul should have been pulled in pieces of them, commanded the soldiers to go down and to take him by force from among them and bring him right here, back to Fortress Antonia. You got to admit, beloved, that the council didn't get too far in their investigation with the Apostle Paul. By the time the Apostle Paul got done, the Roman soldier, for fear of Paul's life, had to haul him out of that room. And as they're hauling Paul out of the room, you find these two major factions of the Sanhedrin basically clawing each other to death. Guess what? I like that. You can judge me if you want, but I just like that. I like how Paul was able to turn the table. You got to admit, Paul didn't say much other than what? I've lived in good conscience before man and God up until this day. He was slapped across the face. He said a few words, bad words about the high priest. Then he was put back in his place. Then he quotes the law saying, oops, he shouldn't speak evil about blah, blah, blah. And then when he perceives the composition, he just simply throws what? The bunker buster bomb right in the middle of the council. Oh, by the way, I'm a Pharisee. My father was a Pharisee. And I stand before you condemned for the hope of Israel, not a millennial reign, but of the bodily resurrection from the dead. And off the races the council went. Off they went, clawing each other. I like that. I believe that's a fulfillment of Luke 21. Jesus says, when you do stand before the councils, and you stand before these kings and the emperors and the prime ministers, don't bat an eye on what you're going to say. I'm going to give you the words. And when I give you those words, no man is able to gainsay nor resist you. I think of the prophets of old. When they stood before God's people in the Old Testament, Jeremiah, Isaiah, men of that caliber, and they stood before the kings and before his counselors and told them exactly the truth. They did everything in their power to silence their lips, but God was with them. Turn to Matthew chapter 3, just before we wind down here and close. Matthew chapter 3, I made a comment or two before I got somewhat sidetracked, that Jesus was quite vicious with these people. Matthew chapter 3, notice first off, John the Baptist, his biological cousin. But when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees come to his baptism, so John the Baptist was not confused on the composition of the Sanhedrin. Now the big boys may be, but not the ones that were there. He said unto them, O generation of what? Vipers? Who had warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bring forth therefore fruits meet for repentance. And think not to say within yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. Beloved, sorry, John the Baptist was questioning whether they were truly Abraham's seed. Now, they were Abraham's seed biologically, genetically, but they were not Abraham's seed in the spirit, in the heart. For I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. But notice his words. He called them a bunch of snakes. So John the Baptist knew the Sanhedrin fully well. Look at Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15, 1 to 3. I made reference to this a while back. Then came to Jesus scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem. So that's the same council of Acts 23, saying, "Why do thy disciples transgress the tradition of the elders?" That would be the Talmudic interpretations. "For they wash not their hands when they eat bread." So here's a question: you're not washing your hands with soap and water, and then you're going to put food in your mouth. He answered and said unto them, "Why do you also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition? For God commanded, saying, Honor thy father and mother, and he that curseth father or mother, let him die the death." That's Exodus 21:17 and Leviticus 20, verse 9. "But ye say, Whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, Oh, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me, and honoreth not his father or mother, he shall be free. Thus have ye made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition." So Jesus was not kind to these people. Turn to chapter 16, same book. Look at verse 5. When his disciples were come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Then Jesus said unto them, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So again, Jesus was not confused on the composition of the Sanhedrin. But he's telling them, beware. Beware of what comes out of the mouth from either side of that council. Matthew 22. Matthew 22, look at verse 23. Matthew 22, 23. The same day came to him the Sadducees, which say that there is no resurrection, and asked him, saying, and then they give Jesus a hypothetical. Okay, a hypothetical situation that was so stupid. Notice verse 29. Jesus answered and said unto them, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. And yet these guys were supposed to be not only the political, but the religious leaders of the people. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. But as touching the resurrection of the dead, have ye not read that which was spoken unto you by God, saying, quote, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Now, stop and think. These were Sadducees who brought this hypothetical. They don't believe in any of that stuff. And yet Jesus said, oh, by the way, have you not read in the Old Testament that God addresses himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the present tense? He's not the God of those rotting in the grave. He's the God of the living, which the Sadducees outright rejected. Acts 4. And then we'll close. Acts chapter 4. Look at verse 1. And as they spake unto the people, the priest and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them. Now remember, the Sadducees were, Acts chapter 4, verse 1. Remember, the Sadducees were in political bed with the Romans. And the Romans were looking to this gang to keep peace and tranquility. As long as there's peace and tranquility, you guys can run your little empire there in the eastern regions of the Roman Empire, and hands off by the power of Rome. Being grieved that they taught the people and preached through Jesus the resurrection from the dead. Notice, what was the Sadducees ticked off? The resurrection. What did Paul say in Acts 23? I stand before you condemned, because I believe in the hope of the resurrection from the dead. There it is. And they laid hands on them and put them in hold unto the next day, for it was now eventide. Howbeit, many of them which heard the word believed, and the number of men was about 5,000. So here's Paul before the Sanhedrin. And apparently that meeting didn't last too long. While that Roman soldier was hauling him out of there for his life's sake, there was a rip-roaring theological debate. Red hot on that council. And Paul simply was escorted away. I would imagine, maybe whistling a tune, or maybe with a little sheepish grin. Well, may God's word forever be blessed. Amen.